everybody. It's the Week in the Tackle podcast, the podcast where we look at the previous week in football and or soccer. Do, and tackle it. I'm Tom Rennie. Alongside me for today's programme, as ever, is star of MLS TV coverage, a man who pulls off a salmon suit like no one since Liberace. It's Danny Brian Dunseth. How are you, mate? You all right?
I'm good, Rennie. I'm good. I had a little bit of an issue, though. We had spring forward here on Saturday night, and I don't know about you, but I still don't trust the technology. It's like when you oversleep that one time because your alarm didn't go off. And from that point, you have PTSD for the better part of the next 12 months that you're going to wake up in the middle of the night because you haven't set your alarm. You might have accidentally put it on PM instead of AM, or maybe you were filling the pool and you left the water on all night long and jumped out of bed at like 3 a.m. and sprinted downstairs in your chonies, your little undies, to make sure that the water was off. But the water was on. It was leaking. It was going into your neighbor's yard. May or may not have happened. All I'm saying, Rennie, is that it was about 1:45 when I decided to Google search when spring forward was going to kick in on Austin time. I realized it was 2 o'clock. I stayed up at 1:59. 2 o'clock hit, shot to 3, felt good about myself. And then my mind wouldn't turn off. And I still had to get up at 4:45 to grab my Lyft to the airport to fly home. And Austin Airport, please work on your security. 25 minutes with clear. It's just a lot. So, yeah, I'm good, Rennie. I'm good. How are you, buddy? How's life?
I mean, you don't sound particularly good. That was a lot of gripes in what was supposed to be essentially social politeness.
I'm fantastic.
No, I'm all right. I mean, we might not have time to do it on today's program because there are more interesting things. But I tell you what, I did have a bit of a Calvin Phillips meltdown the weekend. I did
just
a smidgeroony of one because I went to West Ham Burnley. Sure, Sunday I could have gone to Aston Villa Tottenham. I actually probably could have got a ticket for Liverpool Man City. But I thought, you know what? No, I am the fanatical. And I do feel like I'd like to go to that game. And I thought, you know what? We'll win that. So that'd be fun. And they lined up exactly the same as the Bournemouth game a few weeks ago, which did not work to accommodate Calvin Phillips with James Ward-Prowse on the left wing, which is wildly dumb for someone who's been in charge of 1,000 games. And just, you look, I just at this point, and it will bring us to Aaron Ramsdale later in the programme, West Ham United are not responsible for the self-esteem of Calvin Phillips. And I feel like it's part of the conversation. Oh, but he's England place. And oh, but, you know, you've got to build up his confidence. And it's like, well, yes and no. This is a temporary secondment. And when you hire someone temporarily, you know, in the NHS, it's called getting someone from bank to cover a selection of shifts. Or I hire a commentator to cover one game or whatever. We have a sub presenter in on Sirius XM, whatever. I don't like give them an entire day of being utterly garbage and just let them off the hook. He's so bad and so uncommitted. He doesn't tackle. He doesn't run. He can't pass. He seems to have not got better in the now month and a half, nearly 2 months that he's been there. And yet he's, you know, Gareth Southgate was there. Gareth Southgate's there. And I don't want to keep going on about the England squad and the European Championship because it's kind of irrelevant who's in squad position 21 or 22. But like, I just don't even think he should be in the Premier League anymore. I feel like he needs to go and do another thing as opposed to, I just can't see him again. I can't see him again. Awful signing. And I saw him described recently, you know, I've discovered recently, like, you know, there's this dark Brandon thing with Joe Biden or whatever. And I read recently that he's dark Lingard. That's what Calvin Phillips is, because essentially Jesse Lingard came in on loan and saved the season and began this 4-year period of European qualification, whereas Calvin Phillips is the exact opposite. His role is to essentially bring West Ham United down from the inside. That's what I can only assume he's doing. Otherwise, I don't know. God bless him and all that. Anyway, more on that to come. Maybe, I don't know. Let's start with talking about Liverpool against Manchester City, Danny. I'd love to get your view on this game. Before I do, though, I'll just read you some data. You know how we love the data here. Going into the game on Sunday, our statsmen at Opta had it like this. If Man City were to win at Anfield, they would have a 68% probability of winning the Premier League, with Liverpool on 17 and Arsenal on 15. We end the weekend with City still favourites on 48%. Liverpool are now on a 33% probability, and Arsenal have just pipped up to 19, even though they're the team top currently. So, with that being said, from the weekend, a 1-1 draw, things are tightening ever so close in that top three right now, 64, 64 and 63. What did you make to the 1-1 draw broadly? And how much did you enjoy the game? I mean, it got the hype. Did it deliver?
I think it certainly did deliver. I thought it was a great showpiece for what I think are two of the teams, specifically in the Premier League, but I think worldwide, when we're talking about domestic and international football, that they're the top of the mountain. The quality, let me just pull it back. At the end of the day, the eyeball test was passed from kickoff to final whistle. But the difference between the two were just margins, just these slight little margins. And it could be, you know, proactive versus reactive. It could be stepping in the space or stepping in tight 1v1. It could be shifting the ball to the left, shifting the ball to the right. It could be a goalkeeper anticipating off the line or, you know, hesitation for a quick second. It could be intervention of the referee and or the AR. It could be the non-intervention of VAR. I mean, a sending off worthy challenge versus a last man challenge versus the difficulty of the angle. All of these things, you could talk about roster value versus roster depth. You could talk about players that are injured, players are being developed. All of these things, it literally checked every single box, including controversial moments in which you thought that if it's any other point in the game, if it's not that late, is it a penalty? Is it not a penalty? Oh, well, he's got the ball. Well, that's not what you justify getting the ball for some of these tackles when players go through the ball and endanger the safety of the opponent and all this stuff. And I am getting more and more to the point, and I hate saying this, Tim Horsey, just bleep out everything that I'm about to say, because I'm going to give credit to Tom Rennie because I'm actually buying into this now. Varzar.
Yes!
Varzar. I'm now convinced myself. Now I'm going to do a little bit of a twist. You ready? Because Howard Webb has so much time on his hands that he can do a weekly television show to justify the decisions made by the referee, he being the ultimate decider, why not just keep him in Stockley Park? Why not just give him a screen setup? Why not just say, Howard, yeah, this tackle right now, Brighton, Nottingham Forest, what do you think? Hey, Howard, I know it doesn't really fall into the category of a VAR intervention, but did you see that Kai Havertz dive? Hey, Howard, I don't know if you want to be involved here, but Jeremy Doku, his foot's pretty high. What do you think? That could be effectively the Varzar solution. I think I've come around on it, Tom Rennie.
I like your twist on my excellent idea, because if you're at work when you're broadcasting or when you were playing, many people listening when they're at work, when they have an issue, what's the first thing you do? You consult your line manager, who then consults a senior manager. And usually in a good workplace, you won't be consulting a different manager every time you want direction. And so having the head of the referees always available to be the final arbiter and then having to take personal responsibility for these things makes so much sense. You know, when someone says, why don't you try drinking water through a cup and not just using your hands? And suddenly you think to yourself, why have I been using my hands all this time? That's wild. Like the man who invented the fork. Try this for spaghetti. It's weird. You're getting all tomato sauce over your fingers. You might have just done that. You may have just invented the fork for the Italians. I like that.
Thank you.
It's good.
As I was kind of thinking about it more and more, I mean, you got to have... So Pierluigi at the World Cup is the guy that makes all the final decisions. Mark Geiger out here at Pro makes all the decisions. Howard Webb, big dog over in England, makes all the decisions. You wanted one guy to make all the decisions. We have the guy who's ultimately responsible for all of the referees below him making decisions. If there's a cock-up, we know whose responsibility it is.
It'll save him a lot of time in writing letters on Monday morning as well, which is nice. What did you think it was a penalty? Because I'll just say it right now. I think this is a pretty clear penalty. I think Liverpool were desperate for a penalty, as shown by Mo Salah rolling back the years and giving us a vintage Mo Salah dive a couple of minutes beforehand. I'll never forgive him for that dive against West Ham when Arthur Masuaku was just standing near him. And I'm sure many other people have a similar complaint about other players. Not to say Salah's the only diver, but he does dive. Everyone does. But... I just wonder whether them being so desperate for a penalty plays into the conversation. I wonder whether the fact City were clever and won the toss and made them kick towards the Anfield Road end and not the Kop influences this decision, because I actually think the conversation here, Danny, shouldn't be whether or not it's a penalty. I think the conversation should be similar to what we're talking about with the Forest-Brighton game, or Brighton-Forest game at almost the same time, about Jakub Moda and whether he should have been sent off for his challenge in that game, and he wasn't. The conversation should be, should Jeremy Doku be getting sent off for studs up, kick in the stomach, as if he's stone cold in 2000, just about to deliver a stunner? Like, that's what it looked like here, the gut kick before the drop. And it's a clear penalty. It's a clear foul for me. It's clearly dangerous and reckless. I do think there is a sense of brutality to it. And that brings us to the conversation of red card, yellow card. For it to not even be a foul, I can see why Jurgen Klopp was upset. I want to talk about how he showed that upsetness shortly, but I can see why he would be as furious as he was.
Very, very simply for me, I've got no skin in the game. That should have been a red card. And again, this is split-second incident, the speed of play. I'm very sympathetic to the referees with the elements at this level that they're dealing with. But at a bare minimum, I thought there should have been a suggestion to go to the monitor and have a different angle to see the judgment of what the non-call was. For Doku, any moment that you lift your foot that high above your waist and your studs are shown, whether you get the ball, the toe poke, the touch, however, you've put yourself in a really bad position. I don't think McAllister did anything wrong in that situation other than to try to win the ball back. And again, I just wonder, and there has to be an inherent understanding at that stage of the match, that time of the match, that the referee did not want to make a game-altering change, knowing that the level of the call had to supersede a clear and obvious factor for the referee, the VAR, to get involved. So either way, make a decision, not make a decision. It's not the technology's fault. It's the application of this the verbiage of clear and obvious mistake.
Yeah.
For me, if I'm in that situation, Jeremy Doku, I think that I've just given the referee a reason to point to the spot.
Yeah, but that wasn't given, and it led to, and I'd love to get your view on this, as we've spoken about this before with Jurgen Klopp. You know, I went to the Carabao Cup final a couple of weeks ago, as you know, and I was really surprised in the post-match press conference and in his interviews before he came to see the press conference people, that he was sort of slagging off the referee and slagging off decisions. And yes, maybe there should have been a red card for Caicedo on Gravenberch and all that sort of stuff. I get the grievances, but I just feel like now Jurgen Klopp seems like someone who maybe isn't happy with who he's become. And the reason I say that is, you know how we all have bad and worse versions of ourselves? Some people have it where after four drinks, they're a delight. But after five drinks, they're a really obnoxious bastard. and so when we go to family parties, it's someone's bar mitzvah. We stop drinking so as to not, you know, vomit in the chocolate fountain because we know it's going to go that way. You know, I feel like being Liverpool manager, having all these injustices that happen at football clubs over the long period he's been there, it feels like they're racking up and racking up and racking up. And I feel like there's a sense of embitteredness now about Jurgen Klopp, which wasn't there as much before. It's always sort of been there, but I feel like he can't get over it. And the way he was to the referee in his face at the end of that game, I think Michael Oliver should have shown him a red card, which you can do post-match. I just don't accept, even though Michael Oliver, in my opinion, was wrong, that he should have been shouting directly in his face like he was. And I feel like this is part of why Jurgen Klopp is leaving, because I don't think he likes the person he is becoming and the Premier League is making him. And I feel like he's not the kind of guy who would usually behave in this way. And I think retired Jurgen Klopp would be embarrassed by Sunday's Jurgen Klopp.
What I would suggest is that he has a mental Rolodex of moments throughout his tenure as Liverpool manager with different referees that he's felt hard done by. And I can tell you what happens because I've been there as a player. The moment that you see a certain referee that you have a history with, and their name is embedded in that sheet of paper for your match, you basically go, see, I didn't do that for you, Tim, because I did so many last week. I held it right there. Or like, yes, I love this referee. You know, you have these pros and cons throughout the course of the season, depending on, even down to ARs, you know, fourth officials, guys that you like, guys that you don't like. And that could be a cult of personality, could be the way they manage the game, and or it could just simply be that you felt you were hard done by a call. But yeah, after all these years, certainly Michael Oliver has made a decision or has not made a decision that Jurgen Klopp has taken personally. That felt like that had taken points, that was game-altering, game-changing, ultimately had some type of effect. This non-call has a huge effect because it's two more points in the back pocket of Liverpool. It would, if they converted the penalty, obviously, it's another positive goal differential that they can add to it. And knowing with the way that Arsenal's playing right now, goal differential could be, you know, a big issue when it's all said and done. So I agree with you with regards to the demonstrative presence that he brings on the sideline with the fourth official, with the AR in front of him. And then ultimately, I don't know if I use the word confrontation, but he certainly made it very clear to everybody inside of that stadium that he felt he was hard done by that non-call. And he was going to give Michael Oliver a piece of his mind. But I think this goes back to, in my humble opinion, what needs to change with every single league around the world. The referees should have no interaction with the players. The referees should have no interaction with the manager. The referees should be surrounded by the security in the central part of the midfield, and no player should be allowed to go in that center circle. They want to shake hands. They want to give bones. They want high fives. They want to swap jerseys. They want to do anything. That's fine. But nobody, the referees should plant their asses right in the middle of the kickoff spot, and no one should be able to enter that area. And then that way, everybody vacates the field, and then the referees leave the field. That should, if you do enter that area, then you should be fined. You should be suspended. You should be punished. Because what we've done now is we've created an opportunity for these managers who are redlined through the roof, the opportunity to get their final say and just give a verbal battering to these referees.
Yeah.
And even if they did make mistakes, even if they did completely screw it up, we now have no way to protect the referees from the verbal volleys and or abuse that they get post-game. So let everyone cool off. And then you can have that conversation. You can have that cup of tea. You can eat your sandwich while a certain manager is in there trying to have his gripes or have his complaints. You can do whatever you need, but I don't like the visual of this because it affords everybody else the opportunity to have. Now, that's not everybody because, you know, people go and shake their hands. Hey, good game. Thank you very much. Respect you. Blah, blah, blah. Good stuff. All that. But I just don't think it's a good look. And I do believe that that's one simple solution to getting this kind of dark side out of the game.
I want to ask you about one or two other bits of the game before we move on to some other stories. It's such a big game, so we'll try and keep these elements brief, but I'd love to see what you think about them. How about that bit in this match where Erling Haaland's running at Virgil van Dijk? I mean, you so rarely get a one-on-one as pure as that in this sport. And it was a bit like, I was thinking of it being sort of like Apollo Creed and Rocky, but then that would mean Haaland's Rocky. It was almost like Ivan Drago against Apollo Creed.
Yeah.
Before he kills him, spoiler alert. It was 40 years ago, that movie. Give me a break.
But not just, in real life. Poor Travis.
No, God bless him. But how about that moment, and what did you make to the way both players handled it? For those that missed it, in the end, it's a shot from Haaland that's easily saved by Kelleher as Van Dijk kind of controls where he's able to run to.
I think what we're seeing right now is Virgil Van Dijk is in the similar form that he was a few years ago when, without a shadow of a doubt, who's the best defender in the world, pre-ACL tear, Jordan Pickford. He is class personified with the way, from a center back's perspective, the way that he reads the game, the way that he plays the game, and just how good he is. I really, really enjoy watching him. I'm certainly no Liverpool fan, but when I see a really, really good player, he is certainly in the top five center backs around the world right now with the form that he's in, as he once was a few seasons ago. And this is, listen, I know the narrative surrounding Erling Haaland, that he, you know, he scores goals against the other teams. It's the big teams that he struggles to score. Listen, he's a monster. He's a monster. And I thought that Virgil van Dijk read him well, knowing that his push was going to be to his left. How do you cut down the angle? How do you minimize the shot? How do you minimize the effect? How do you cut down that angle for the goalkeeper to read? It was just a really good, fun matchup to watch. And I think all of us wanted to see more and more of that 1v1, who could get the better of each other.
Yeah, maybe you want to get rid of penalties and just do one-on-ones like the playground, like basketball. Yeah. Style. It's been fantastic. Luis Diaz, I wanted to speak to you about him because the Carabao Cup final a couple of weeks ago, I think the brilliance of his performance and the sheer amount of effort he put in was understandably overshadowed by Van Dijk scoring and, you know, the Klopp's kids narrative. We had enough to go on, so we didn't necessarily need, unless you were doing a deep dive, to do too much on Luis Diaz. But I'll pick him out again here. Just maximum effort. Tell us a little bit about Luis Diaz and why he seems like he is working so much harder than everyone else, even though the other players are also giving maximum effort, but compared to Luis Diaz, they look almost lazy.
I remember when he came from Porto and everybody was trying to say, well, no, he needs time to adapt. This is the Premier League. He needs time to adapt. He is one of the few players where I use as a reference point as that is such a bullshit statement. Sorry, Tim. They need time to adapt. Give him time to adapt. Because how does Luis Diaz come in the Premier League and look like he's been a Liverpool player for 20 years? I mean, literally checks every box in terms of monster mentality, insane technical ability, and like you said, the desire to put in the work on both sides of the ball. I agree with you. I think we all kind of did a disservice to not point out the amount of effort that he put in for the 120 minutes against Chelsea in that final. He was superb, even to the point where he was dead. And, you know, like the ball, like he would make a 60-yard run, wouldn't get the pass. He just put his head down and just like, I got to get back. Got to get back to a good starting spot. And like, I was actually pointing it out to my son, Shia, and like, dude, watch the way he's got the mentality and the mindset to get back, not walk back, get back and then take a breather to prepare for the next burst. Like, that's what you have to have. That's what elite players have. I said it back when Colombia missed out on the World Cup. It was a travesty that we weren't going to see a player like Luis Diaz perform at that high level. I think he's a phenomenal, phenomenal player. And I don't know if I'd go as far as to say he's undroppable when Jurgen Klopp has a full Liverpool side, but he is certainly one of the most, I think, impactful elements on the offensive phase of play and the defensive transition for Jurgen Klopp and the way that they like to play.
Two other final quick bits. Kevin De Bruyne was taken off in this game. Oh, 65 minutes or so. Mateo Kovacic came on. There was the row. I'd love your view on that. It went on, for those that missed it, to the point where Guardiola goes up to the seats in the dugout to continue the dialogue with Kevin De Bruyne, who was not happy with being taken off. But also, Danny, I'd love your view on the fact that City were struggling to get control of a game of football in midfield with Kevin De Bruyne in the team.
Let's start there. I thought that... I love your star jumps. I thought that that's how good Liverpool was. I mean, I think there's a conversation to be had about when we talk about spend and net spend, we talk about costs. We obviously talked about Caicedo and Enzo relentlessly over the course of the season. To see McAllister get over the line so early from Brighton, to see both Fabinho and Jordan Henderson tempted by Saudi Arabian money and get out from underneath their value and maybe their their weight of leadership and desire to play, and then ultimately finding Endo, which nobody had on their bingo card, and see how those two. I'll use a quote I got from Chris in Orlando that he sent me a message about Endo. He said he puts in his mouth guard and just gets to work, and then he just got, you know, game over, goes home with his family. He clocks in, clocks out, and those two, I thought, when you think about value, extraordinary. Extraordinary value for the level of performance that they're getting out of those two players. So it speaks volumes to how difficult they made it against Man City. The surprise for me was that, yes, Kevin De Bruyne came out because of the equity of knowing that Kevin De Bruyne in a split second could turn the game on its head and hit a pass that 90, what it feels like 99% of the world can't see, that he's able to do something special. His finishing ability, his playing ability, this had nothing to do with management of the knee and or the hamstring. This was just pure tactical. I could not believe, I saw Kovacic and I was like, oh, that makes sense. See the game out, you know, find a little bit more balance, blah, blah, blah. Could not believe that I saw his number come up. Not surprised by the reaction. The amount of times we've heard Pep Guardiola talk about the respect that he has for De Bruyne, but also the dialogue that those two players had. Not surprised to see Pep try to explain himself to Kevin De Bruyne, understanding the importance of the manager's relationship with the player and kind of this ungodly-like desire to win. And I'm not surprised to see Pep go into the stand and sit with him to try to help him understand in the moment with how heated he was, why he took him off. Afterwards, Pep kind of said what he said, and he justified why he justified the move, and saying everything's going to be fine, blah, 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 which cooler heads will prevail. But yeah, I was like everyone else, like, ooh, okay. Well, I mean, when Jurgen Klopp probably saw that come up, he was like, yes, okay, yes. We get him off the field. This is going to be amazing. One less person that we have to worry about.
And the final question on this for now is that it's potentially, we could have an FA Cup final between City and Liverpool as we record this, that they're in the quarterfinals this weekend, but that is potentially the final match between Liverpool and Man City in this era. It's potentially the final match of Pep Guardiola up against Jurgen Klopp, something a lot of people have been kind of talking about in a kind of melancholic way over the last few days, because, you know, it is the end of that era. This era has been defined by what these two men have done with these two teams. And, you know, we have our say, and I do all the time, on how Man City are built and almost the injustice that we didn't have a closer race between these two because, you know, one was backed by a country and one, though incredibly wealthy, compared to City are not, compared to 90 other teams are, but compared to City are not. I think it's 5-1 in terms of Premier League title, City to Liverpool, but it's been the defining narrative of the era. Those title races that have gone above 90 points for both teams, which this year probably will again, have been incredible, the likes of which we simply have not seen before. The calibre of matches, we went through them on Friday's Sirius XMFC show, from the famous John Stones, the Champions League games, the FA Cup semi, these incredible matches they've put on. And I told the story, which I'll briefly mention here, on Friday. I was at a pub once for a night game between these two. I think it would have been a late Saturday. And I was off work and I was in a pub in London, West London, and no one's a Liverpool fan, no one's a City fan, and they're playing on the big screen. And the game was so good and so breathtaking at the Etihad Stadium. I forget the game now, I had it in my notes on Friday, but people just stopped talking. They stopped talking about other things. They stopped thinking about what was coming next. I even stopped getting drinks at the bar because the quality of the game was so, it left you slack-jawed at the quality and speed and intensity and variation of football. And it was in Liverpool's kind of golden front three era. Yeah. And I just wonder what you think about the legacy of these matchups, the quality that we have seen, and whether you think we'll see these two lock horns again.
I would say the legacy for me is timeless. I think this will be a timeless legacy of remember when, you know, we're going to be looking back at highlight packages and reference points and, you know, kind of like what we do with, we kind of see the black and white footage back in the day. I think we're going to do the same thing when we talk about, you know, this era of the modern game, when we're talking about the incredible investment of money and whether justifiable or not, less about where the money came from, but more about the investment in the game and how these these teams were constructed. And we'll get into the nitty-gritty about development and construction of rosters versus buying the world's best players. That's inevitable. But I was thinking about this throughout the game, Tom. There was a bit of, I don't know, melancholy, I guess. Just thinking like, God, you know, we saw this incredible rivalry between Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund and the two getting the better of each other. And then they brought it to the Premier League. And then they recreated it here at the Premier League. And knowing that that could theoretically be the very last time we see him go back and forth. Yeah, man, it was it's a bit sad, right? Like, so much fun watching the way they interpret the little tweaks of the game. Even the goal for John Stones, you know, how just those little minuscule bits of information that they're then able to expose to create these little fine margins of moments. Again, not my coaches, not my team, but from a pure fun, eyeball test, loving, excitement, have to tune in. These are the type of teams that have been built with these type of managers is exactly what our game has needed. And I think we're going to miss them. I really do. I think we're going to miss them. Somebody else will pop up. There'll be another great manager. But, you know, as much as they piss you off in the moment, they're really incredibly talented managers at the top of their game, without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, giving us lots of great entertainment. And most importantly, hashtag content. The game, I saw a great headline in the Times this morning, which was the first half was won by Manchester City. The second half was won by Liverpool. The game was won by Arsenal. Arsenal won the weekend. They are top of the table. Their next game in the Premier League is the 31st of March at Manchester City. So that's going to be an incredible game. Don't worry, my ticket application is in. Arsenal won this weekend. They beat Brentford by 2-1. Similar story to the start of the season. Kai Havertz scoring a late goal at Brentford. Ramsdale having a terrible match. This weekend, Havertz scored a late winning goal and Ramsdale had a terrible match. Before we do the Havertz thing, I'd love your view on Aaron Ramsdale, because I was doing the game alongside Eddie McGoldrick, the former Arsenal and City winger. And you know that bit in the third Naked Gun movie, which is often gift around, where they're at the Oscars and one character has a bomb, Frank Drebin has a gun, and he's like, wait, I'm the policeman, you're the terrorist. You should have the bomb and I should have the gun. And they swap him over and everyone in the crowd goes, and they just slap their hand on their forehead because they can't believe he's just done that. Eddie McGoldrick and I were doing the commentary next to each other. When Whistler's closing in, you know when you just sort of like, and Whistler's closing in, so he's going to clear it now. He's going to clear it now, right? He's going to clear it. Clear it. Aaron, clear it. Doesn't clear it. Whistler closes him down. He scores. And we both, I am kidding you not, both went at the exact same time. And I imagine 60,000 other people inside Emirates Stadium did as well. I will say Aaron Ramsdale then goes on to make one of the saves of the season from that incredible effort from Ivan Toney when the score is 1-1, backpedaling towards his own goal. But we've spoken about this a fair few times, Dunny. The way Arteta destroyed Aaron Ramsdale at the start of this season, you can't expect him to just come back in and everything's all right, can you? Or can you?
Yeah, I felt the same way when I watched it. I could not believe I was sitting in my hotel room in Austin and I was finishing up my notes and I was like, same idea. Lump it, slump it, slump it. Again, not my goalkeeper, not my manager, not my team, but I've always felt bad for the manner in which he lost his position, because I don't think he did anything wrong. I don't. And listen, we can talk about last year. We can talk about the mistakes, and we can talk about this whole ideology of becoming more and more of a feet first type of goalkeeper that we're seeing in the modern game. But keep possession when you need to keep possession. Don't force possession when you don't need to force possession. And it's okay to play direct at times, even if you're a smaller team, because the idea is when you pick up the second ball in the midfield. The definition of insanity of trying to build through the high press at times, you can do it against the teams that are weaker than you, but the teams that high press, you got to be really careful. All I saw was a goalkeeper that wanted to prove to his manager, as well in the back of his mind, prove to his national team manager, that he was a worthy goalkeeper of a starting position in the Premier League, that he was better with his feet than what he's been labeled with, that he had an insatiable urge to prove to Mikel Arteta that in tight moments with pressure, he could find solutions and he could play out. And that's what that was. It was a player with not a lot of game rhythm every single weekend in a moment that's different with different pressures than there is in training. And I felt like he was like, this, sorry, Tim, I'll show him I can do it. And you just feel horrible for him. I felt horrible for him. Again, I've got no skin in the game. Felt horrible for him. Loved his personality at the All-Star game in DC, by the way. So came up with some big saves. Still think Kai Havertz should have been shown second yellow for that Greg Louganis-esque dive. That keeps him on the field. They get the game-winning goal. Arsenal are winning the games they should. They are snatching victories out of the jaws of draws and ties. And they're right back where they want. And I just wonder now, what were the lessons learned last year and how can they apply them this year? And by the way, Gabriel and Ben White are two players that are easily despised by everyone else in the world, but absolutely adored by their manager and their fans. Because the dark arts and the unnecessary confrontations and the attitude in which they bring to the game could be considered a winner's attitude if you're alongside of them. But from the outside, tough pill to swallow.
They also are big fans of Ben White, I think, at a local business called Supertans, making a fortune. I mean, he's spending far too much time under those lights. The Kai Havertz thing, I mean, look, it's a second yellow. It should be a second yellow. It's not given as a second yellow. Thomas Frank, understandably, the Brentford manager, is absolutely furious about it. Yeah. Are we at a situation now? Look, cheating's always been part of the game forever and a day. Diving for a penalty has always been part of the game forever and a day, right? I always think of Rodney Marsh, you don't dive, don't get, right? Take your book in or get a penalty. That's a decent risk-reward ratio there. But are we at a situation? Diving doesn't feel like it's a big issue anymore. A few years ago, it was retrospective bans for diving. I remember Manuel Lanzini once got one for a dive at West Ham Stoke when he dived and won West Ham a penalty and they won the game and Stoke went down that season. So, you know, it does matter. I don't think that was a dive, but whatever. Should we be finding a way? Should we have a dive czar as well as Howard Webb as the VAR czar? And he's like, that's a dive, mate.
Yeah, I mean, my whole thing is, and this is coming from a former central defender's perspective, if you go down without contact and you're trying to draw the penalty and you're throwing yourself to the ground, I always say he's pulled up the landing gear, meaning that he's thrown his feet out from underneath him. I do believe that it should be 100% absolutely a booking. Now, it's different so just to be very clear, if there's no contact whatsoever and a player's thrown himself to ground or trying to initiate contact, and zero contact, that's the line, zero contact, it should be 100% a yellow card every single time. Now, I think where the gray area becomes is there enough contact for him to lose his balance and or manipulate the body weight against the ability to hit a clean shot? That's going to be up for determination. But very simply, if a player goes down without being touched whatsoever, throws his legs out from underneath them, has to be a yellow card. I don't care what minute. I don't care what the consequences are. I don't care if it's a penalty. I don't care if it's, whatever. It has to. I don't care what time it is in the game. I think at a bare minimum, that should be one of the laws that are introduced to the game.
Final question, because we're nearly out of time for today. I did just want to get your view briefly on Aston Villa against Tottenham Hotspur. And more broadly, from a player's perspective, what it's like to struggle so much in these games. And maybe this is when we talk about, you know, Arsenal struggling at Porto last week, Champions League experience. Maybe we're talking about Aston Villa big game experience. Earlier in the season, they could have gone top of the Premier League and were sort of in conversation, at least, in the title race because of wins against City, wins against Arsenal. They had a home game against Sheffield United and couldn't beat Sheffield United. And it was a 1-1 draw then. When there has been big games for Villa this season, when the pressure is finally on, they have really struggled. I'm thinking about Boxing Day at Manchester United. 2-0 up at half-time. Yeah. Went on to lose that game 3-2. And Man U were in a really bad moment there, and they totally crumbled. And in this game against Tottenham the weekend, it's 0-0 at half-time. and suddenly they go on to lose the game 4-0. John McGinn, brave ass to his friends, stupidly gets himself sent off in one of the most moronic kicking out an opposition player for no reason incidents I think I've seen in many a year.
It's wild.
Wild, just really wild, like an incredible.
Tried to do him, like he swung through. The ball was nowhere near. He swung through. Like I thought it was like a 1983. Like you're playing against Maradona, and you're allowed to tackle like that. Like walloped him.
But that almost felt indicative, Danny, to sort of my question: what happens to a team when they don't have that experience? How difficult is that? And how evidently difficult has it been for Aston Villa and teams like them to get that under control in games like that when it starts not going your way?
Insanely difficult. And listen, the management right now of multiple competitions was going to be a challenge with this roster and keeping everyone fit and healthy. And I think Unai Emery's done really an incredible job. But something wonky's been happening at home. And listen, it's the quality of the opponent, right? It was Newcastle, it was Chelsea, it was Manchester United. Those are the games that they're going to beat the Nottingham Forest, they're going to beat the Burnleys, you know, they're going to do those type of things. But it's weird it should not be a surprise that the struggles they've had at home come against teams that are either level with them in terms of talent and quality and or are better than them. But this home form, certainly a concern. And I would say more so is, the mental aptitude of competition and or crossing that line into red mist. And Jack McGinn wasn't the only one. There was a couple instances where you felt like this became more of like a personal, I got to stoke a fire within us to get us back on to compete and match the levels of intensity we're facing. I was thinking about this. I didn't, when I was watching the game, what does this say more about Aston Villa or about Tottenham? And I was kind of right down the middle, 50-50. I think it shows everything that are the challenges for Aston Villa to hold on to this spot. And it says everything about Ange Postecoglou and what he is creating in real time for Tottenham. So credit where credit's due. I mean, he's getting goals out of Timo Thumbs Werner at this stage. When we thought this was really like an odd throwaway signing because of the amount of injuries that they were dealing with in the January transfer window.
Yeah, it's even been onside every now and then, which has been somewhat incredible as well. Maybe if he starts playing on the last man and is actually running onto the ball for cutbacks, it makes more sense. And that just made it work, mate. And I will just mention this as well, and it's not to excuse West Ham's diabolical first 45 minutes against Burnley, which was like genuinely worse than the Arsenal game, the first 45 against Arsenal, because Arsenal were amazing. Burnley, sorry, Tim, are f***ing rubbish. They are really
good to that.
We did. I know that was my first one, but I earned that one. They were like Burnley are such a bad team. Like Mavropanos was playing like he'd been hit in the head in the morning and hadn't recovered from it. Calvin Phillips, as previously mentioned, it just has no business playing in a Premier League team. On and on. David Moyes playing the same formation against Bournemouth was nonsense. But to tie it back to Villa, we're at the end of the Europa League and kind of Conference League runs, and the Champions League teams, we might see it with Arsenal if they didn't have a big break this weekend, spot of luck because of the FA Cup, they haven't got a game. But that Thursday, Sunday, when the Thursday is intense and a big game, as opposed to a group game where you can maybe make 6, 7, 8 changes, Villa went to Ajax on the Thursday and drew that game 0-0. It was a real tough game against Ajax. West Ham underperformed massively against Freiburg in midweek, but still had to go to Germany and stay in that tie before this week. And it is kind of evident, Danny, that the Europa League and the Conference League campaigners that aren't Liverpool and their incredible sort of quality, there is a drop-off there. There's always been a drop-off there. And if you drop off at home against Tottenham, even against Burnley, if you essentially play with 10 men with Calvin Phillips too, it can make a massive difference to your season, can't it?
I didn't hear a word you said because I'm still laughing about the Mavropanos shot that you took. And what I've realized is that Thilo Kehrer being gone has opened up a 2-for-1 opportunity. Mavropanos, as well as Calvin Phillips, are now two of your most beloved West Ham players that you are now getting new kits drawn up and printed for.
Hey, I was right about Thilo Kehrer, wasn't I? I was right.
That is cup winning Tilo Kehrer to you.
Legend, the legendary useless Tilo Kehrer. That's true, but I was right. I was right about him from the start. The moment I saw him against Brighton, I can assess a player. 10 seconds, I was like, he's crap. And he was. He was crap. Listen, that's us out of time for this week. We'll do more next week. I've got some lovely Eden Hazard stuff for you I'll try and save for next week and a few other bits as well. But that's our time for this week's Week in the Tackle. Danny, always a pleasure. Where are you this weekend? Where can we find you?
I'll be heading up to Seattle. I've got the afternoon kickoff. It's actually be nice for you. Nice little nightcap. Have a nice little glass of whiskey. We've got Seattle against Colorado. It'll be noon kickoff time out on the West Coast. So it'll be a fun one. And then you and I will return Monday because Tuesday I'm getting that brand new hip, bro. So I'm going to have to alter your schedule before you go off on another vacation. By the way, welcome back, Tim Horsey. If you don't take vacation, we won't fucking curse so much. Sorry, Tim.
Sorry, Tim. I hope you had a lovely time. I will mention this as I've forgot to do at the start of the program. Reviews and ratings. We need some more from people. Our numbers are very, very good. Our reviews are very, very positive, but we haven't asked for our new listeners to give us some reviews for a while. So if you enjoyed the podcast, give us a 5-star review on whatever platform you are listening to us on. If you can write a written review and you want to make it positive, please do that for us as well. We always appreciate them. We'll read out the best of them on one of our future programs. So 5-star reviews and positive written reviews would be much appreciated and will help our rating greatly. So do leave a few of those. And we are going to record a show next week. And if we get some really, really good reviews, we'll do another show on the Tuesday when Dunny is high as balls. Right, that's Brian Dunseth. I'm Tom Rennie. Tim Horsey got back from holiday to produce this program. We'll see you next week.